York. This is Democracy Now.
The most astonishing thing was when one of the justices asked the government lawyer, will you allow Abu Zubaydah to testify? It was a stunning question. And the answer was even more stunning. Well, he's being held in Guantanamo. And the justice said, why doesn't he file a habeas petition? Well, he has filed a habeas petition 14 years ago.
The torture cover-up continues. We'll look at Wednesday's Supreme Court oral arguments about Guantanamo prisoner Abu Zubaydah, who was waterboarded over 80 times at a secret CIA black site. The Biden administration argues key details about his torture are state secrets, including the role of two psychologists, Mitchell and Jessen, who designed the torture program. We'll get the latest. Then to Ethiopia.
CNN can reveal, based on documentary evidence and witnesses' accounts, Ethiopian Airlines has been transporting weapons between Ethiopia and Eritrea since the beginning of the war in Ethiopia that has seen thousands killed.
We'll speak to award-winning CNN reporter Naima Obagia about how Ethiopia used its flagship commercial airlines, Ethiopian Airlines, to transport weapons during the war in Tigray. But first, a federal judge has temporarily blocked the near-total ban on abortion in Texas. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Texas, a federal judge has temporarily blocked the state's near-total ban on abortions, granting the Justice Department's emergency request to halt the law while courts consider its legality. In his ruling, Judge Robert Pittman slammed the Texas ban's unconstitutionality, writing, quote, "This court will not sanction one more day of this offensive deprivation of such an important right." We'll have more on the story after headlines. On Capitol Hill, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said Wednesday he would allow an emergency extension of the federal debt limit that would put off the risk of a U.S. default until December. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says a vote is likely today. The World Health Organization's endorsed a first-of-its-kind vaccine against malaria for children in sub-Saharan Africa. The WHO said the vaccine proved to be safe and reduced severe malaria by 30% in children enrolled in a pilot program in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called the vaccine a major victory in the fight against one of the world's worst infectious diseases.
This long-awaited malaria vaccine is a breakthrough for science, child health, and malaria control. Using this vaccine in addition to existing tools to prevent malaria could save tens of thousands of young lives each year.
It's the first vaccine ever approved for use against a parasitic disease. Malaria claims the lives of about 500,000 people each year, half of whom are children in Africa. The United States reported more than 2,500 COVID-19 deaths Wednesday, even as new cases continue to fall from a summer peak. With the latest deaths, the U.S. has now recorded more COVID fatalities in 2021 than in all of 2020. The White House said Wednesday it would spend $1 billion to purchase at-home rapid antigen tests in response to an ongoing nationwide shortage. Los Angeles City Council has approved a measure requiring people entering indoor public spaces and large outdoor gatherings to provide proof of vaccination. In Colorado, the UC Health Hospital system says it will deny organ transplants to patients who refuse to get vaccinated for COVID-19. Most transplant centers already require patients to receive other vaccinations, like for hepatitis and measles, and routinely make organ recipients pledge to abstain from tobacco and alcohol. in Afghanistan. A UN agency will start paying to keep the country's fragile healthcare infrastructure afloat after the flow of international aid dollars, which the health sector relied on, dried up following the Taliban takeover in August. This includes paying the salaries of at least 25,000 health workers. Last month, the Biden administration granted special licenses to some organizations, including the UN, to engage in transactions with the Taliban, which is under U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, the humanitarian situation is becoming increasingly dire. This is Afghanistan Director of the World Food Program, Mary Ellen McGroarty.
The 38 million Afghans who still live in the country are adjusting to a new reality. It is incredibly sad, and over the weeks, a humanitarian crisis has just escalated and magnified at an incredible pace. It's a crisis that has its roots in decades of conflict and the increasing pressures of climate change.
The United Nations Secretary General has appointed Stéphane de Mistura of Italy as his personal envoy for Western Sahara. The appointment comes after the post went vacant for over 2 years. Morocco's occupied Western Sahara since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and international law. Over the past four decades, thousands of Western Sahara's indigenous people, the Sahrawi, have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation. To see our exclusive documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony, go to democracynow.org. Back in the United States, the Education Department is temporarily expanding student loan forgiveness for public service workers. The move is expected to benefit 550,000 people, including teachers, social workers, military members, and others who were previously not included in the public service loan forgiveness program. In Texas, a crude oil spill Wednesday at the Marathon Galveston Bay refinery near Houston is prompting even more calls to break free from fossil fuel dependence. This comes as Southern California confronts one of its worst ever oil spills from an underwater pipeline. Meanwhile, a recent study by the International Monetary Fund found the fossil fuel industry receives subsidies of $11 million per minute, despite pledges by world leaders to fight the climate catastrophe. The Biden administration is restoring several key provisions to the National Environmental Policy Act related to the review process of infrastructure projects. The environmental and community safeguards were gutted last year under the Trump administration. A federal appeals court has blocked a California law banning private prisons, arguing it infringes on federal authority over immigration policy. The California law, which went into effect last year, bans new and renewed contracts with private prisons and phases out all private facilities by 2028, including immigration jails run on behalf of ICE. That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The state of California says it'll appeal the latest ruling. A school shooting in Arlington, Texas, Wednesday left 4 people injured. The suspect, an 18-year-old student, has been taken into custody. The attack sparked renewed calls to tighten Texas's gun laws. Last month, the state's permitless gun law went into effect, which allows people to carry firearms without a license as long as they have no priors with state or federal law. In Colorado, workers at 5 Amazon warehouses are seeking class action status for a lawsuit alleging the retail giant refused to pay them for time spent at employee-mandated COVID-19 screenings before the start of their shifts. The workers say beginning in March 2020, they routinely waited in long lines for up to 1 hour to answer questions about their symptoms and have their temperatures checked. More than 10,000 workers were affected. Under Colorado law, workers must be paid when they're required to be on their employer's premises or on duty. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders is pushing back against Senator Joe Manchin after the West Virginia Democrat said he would oppose much of President Biden's $3.5 trillion 10-year budget reconciliation package known as the Build Back Better Act. Manchin told reporters last week he doesn't want to create a, quote, entitlement society. On Wednesday, Senator Sanders said U.S. working families should be entitled to child care, universal pre-K, affordable prescription drugs, dental and vision benefits, free community college, and a world free from catastrophic climate change. Sanders called on Manchin to make it clear which of these proposals he wants to cut.
The time is long overdue for him to tell us with specificity, not generalities, we're beyond generalities, with specificity, what he wants and what he does not want, and to explain that to the people of West Virginia and America.
This week, immigrants and their supporters began a four-day round-the-clock sleep-out protest outside the Brooklyn home of Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer. They're demanding the Senate Majority Leader overrule the Senate parliamentarian and include immigration policy in the Build Back Better budget reconciliation package. This is Alejandra Marin, an undocumented essential worker member of the group New Immigrant Community Empowerment.
Por eso necesitamos ahora.
We need a change in the laws in this country. We need Congress, President Biden, Kamala, Schumer. We are here in front of your house asking for immigration reform for the 11 million undocumented. We are the backbone, the foundation of this economy. We deserve justice. We deserve equality. We deserve human respect as people, as human beings, as essential workers of this country. For that reason, I'm here with all of you today to fight for a just immigration reform for all immigrants and essential workers of this country.
And the 2021 Nobel Prize in Literature will be awarded to Tanzanian novelist Abaraza Kurna. The Nobel Committee cited his, quote, uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism and the fate of the refugee in the gulf between cultures and continents, unquote. Gurna is the first Black African writer to win a Nobel Prize since Wole Soyinka in 1986. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Texas, a federal judge has temporarily blocked the state's near-total ban on abortions, granting the Justice Department's emergency request to halt the law while courts consider its legality. In his ruling, Judge Robert Pittman slammed the Texas ban's unconstitutionality, writing, quote, "From the moment SBA went into effect, women have been unlawfully prevented from exercising control over their lives in ways that are protected by the Constitution. That other courts may find a way to avoid this conclusion is theirs to decide. This court will not sanction one more day of this offensive deprivation of such an important right." Judge Pittman also accused Texas lawmakers of, quote, "pursuing an unprecedented and aggressive scheme to deprive its citizens of a significant and well-established constitutional right." We go now to Boston, where we're joined by Amy Littlefield, the abortion access correspondent at The Nation. Her recent article on Texas is headlined, "This is what the first hours of a near-total ban on abortion look like." Amy, first talk about the significance of this judge's ruling and what it will mean for Texas.
Well, Judge Robert Pittman, Amy, ruled and said what advocates in Texas and clinic operators in Texas have been saying all along, that Senate Bill 8, which was in effect a near total ban on abortion in the state of Texas, is flagrantly unconstitutional, that the attempt to sort of make an end run around the courts by using civil lawsuits to enforce this law was something that this judge could transparently see through, that this was about banning abortion, which is not allowed under the Constitution as, you know, it's currently interpreted by the courts. However, it's important to note that this is not the final word. And we also don't know exactly how clinics are going to put this ruling into practice. Senate Bill 8, which bans abortion after embryonic cardiac activity can be detected, which happens at between 5 and 7 weeks of pregnancy, which is 1 to 3 weeks after a missed period. Most clinics in the state had continued providing abortions up until cardiac activity. Planned Parenthood of South Texas, for example, actually stopped providing all abortions because they were afraid of getting sued under this law. So we don't know exactly how all of the different abortion providers in Texas are going to move after this ruling. But I know Whole Woman's Health, an independent clinic that has been out in front fighting Senate Bill 8 from the beginning, has said they're going to move as quickly as possible to start resuming abortions, even though the law has this sort of hidden, you know, Russian nesting doll provision that actually allows, even though there's a preliminary injunction in place, it allows abortion providers and anyone who aids or abets in an abortion to be sued while the preliminary injunction is in place retroactively. In other words, if the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court puts this law back into place, anyone who violates it in the meantime, even though it's on hold, could still face a lawsuit. And again, for folks, you know, who haven't been following this, the civil lawsuit provision is what is so nefarious and what gave conservative justices cover to allow this law to go into effect. That is, that instead of being enforced by the state of Texas, this law is enforced by private citizens who can sue anyone who helps someone get an abortion for $10,000.
I mean, and just to elaborate on that for people to understand, it could be the taxi driver who brings a person to a women's health clinic to get an abortion. It could be the anti-abortion activist outside who takes down the license plate, finds out who that is, and sues for $10,000. It could be a person in another state who has nothing to do with this, who sues, for example, as happened, the Texas doctor who gave an abortion to a person.
Yeah, it could be a disbarred attorney in another state under house arrest, who I believe was the first person to sue Dr. Alan Braid when he openly violated the law in Texas. So, yes, I mean, that is the sort of bounty hunter provision of this. But, I mean, the effect has been a near total ban, which is a lot less, you know, creative and exciting and much more sort of transparently the goal of anti-abortion forces all along was to cut off access to abortion in Texas. And we saw this happen in the state previously last year during the pandemic, the sort of height of the pandemic in March and April of 2020. Governor Greg Abbott tried to ban abortion as a non-essential service. And just like Senate Bill 8, that measure wound its way through the courts. Access flipped off and on 8 times. You had clinic staff coming out into the waiting room telling patients who had been sitting there waiting for their procedures, sorry, we just heard that the court ruled against us and you're going to have to go home and we'll call you if we can see you again. You had this sort of back and forth going on. We could see that start to play out again in Texas because immediately this decision in favor of abortion rights has already been appealed to the Fifth Circuit. And of course, the end of the line is the Supreme Court. And I think one of the most significant things about this Texas law is that the Supreme Court showed their hand. They showed that they are ready to allow a near total ban on abortion to go into effect in a state where 1 in 10 women of reproductive age and an untold number of trans and non-binary people capable of getting pregnant live. And we've seen the, you know, human rights consequences, the heartbreaking human rights consequences of that over the past month.
Finally, Amy, before we go, you wrote this piece in The Nation. This is what the first hours of a near total ban on abortion look like. And you talk about a woman named Anna. Can you end by telling us her story?
So, Amy, one thing I learned when I worked for you is always to try to end on a note of hope. And so over the weekend, I traveled to to Washington, D.C. for the Rally for Abortion Justice. And this was hosted by the Women's March. The numbers were nowhere near what they were in 2017, you know, during the inauguration of President Trump, when there were 500,000 people in D.C. and you practically couldn't move. there were about 20,000 people in D.C. There were another 660 rallies around the country for abortion rights taking place during this Texas emergency. But what I really saw emerge, even though the numbers were relatively small, is I saw a new generation of leaders who have been shaped by the cruelty of incrementalism, the cruelty of one law after another, after another, after another in states like Texas. And I saw a woman named Anna, who's now 21 years old, speak from the stage. She tried to get access to hormonal contraception in Texas when the month that she turned 17, but she couldn't get it because, you may not know, Texas actually requires parental permission for teenagers to get abortion, to get not just abortion, but access to contraception. So she couldn't get birth control. She was having sex and a condom broke. And so she went to get emergency contraception, but the store wouldn't sell it to her, even though legally it's supposed to be available over the counter to people of all ages. And there are protections for anyone who wants to deny someone access to Plan B, you know, under purported religious grounds. And so Anna couldn't get access to Plan B. When she tried to fight for her rights in the store, they threatened to call security on her. And by the time she finally got Plan B, she said, you know what, I think it's too late. And she took a pregnancy test every single day. When it turned up pregnant, that she was pregnant, she immediately knew that she had to seek a judicial bypass procedure, because in Texas, you have to have a parent's permission to get an abortion if you're a minor. And because her parents lived overseas, she had to ask a judge for permission. She had to prove that she was a good student, prove that she was mature enough, capable of making a decision about an abortion. And from the stage, I heard her say, I'm not a baby making machine. I should get to decide what I want to do. And I thought, this is the generation that has been radicalized, that has been moved, that has been shaped and forged in what one activist called the hell that is Texas right now. And this is the generation that's rising to power now, that's going to lead us forward. And they use terminology and rallying cries that are so different from the 1990s when, you know, Roe was under threat in the Planned Parenthood v. Casey case. They talk about, you know what, it's okay to have an abortion after some hot sex just because you don't want to be pregnant. That is a far cry from the safe, legal, and rare calls that we heard in the 90s. They talk about pregnant people. They talk about trans and non-binary folks who have abortion. They are intersectional. They center Black women in their work. And this movement of young people of color, like Anna, is ready to lead. And it was really exciting to see it emerge in D.C.
Well, I want to thank you, Amy, for being with us. We will link to your piece at the March for Abortion Rights, A New Generation of Activists Take Center Stage, as well as your piece, This Is What the First Hours of a Near Total Ban on Abortion Looks Like. Amy Littlefield is the abortion access correspondent at The Nation and former Democracy Now! Producer. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the torture cover-up continues. We'll look at Wednesday's Supreme Court oral arguments in a case brought by Guantanamo prisoner Abu Zubaydah, who was waterboarded over 80 times at a secret CIA black site. Stay with us. Mirror of the Stone by Camelia Gibran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at the Biden administration's attempts to keep secret information about the U.S. torture program following the September 11th attacks. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard a case brought by Abu Zubaydah, a Guantanamo prisoner who was waterboarded over 80 times while being held at a CIA black site. His legal team has spent years trying to obtain testimony from two psychologists, Drs. James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who helped the CIA design and implement its torture program. The U.S. government's also trying to keep secret the location in Poland of the CIA black site where Abu Zubaydah was tortured. Wednesday's hearing took a surprising turn when several justices asked why the United States is refusing to allow Abu Zubaydah to testify himself in an ongoing inquiry in Poland. This is Justice Stephen Breyer questioning Abu Zubaydah's attorney, David Klein.
Why don't you ask Mr. Zubaydah? Why doesn't he testify? Why doesn't Mr. Zubaydah, he was there. Why doesn't he say, this is what happened? And they won't deny it. I mean, I don't think, if he's telling the truth.
You're talking about Mitchell or Jessen.
I'm not. I'm saying the person who was there was I don't know if he's your client. Isn't he your client? His name is on this thing.
Abu Zubaydah.
Yes.
Abu Zubaydah cannot testify.
Why not?
Because he is being held incommunicado. He has been held in Guantanamo.
Why? Why? Just out of, I mean, I'm not sure this is relevant, but I mean, in Hamdi, we said you could hold people in Guantanamo. The words were active combat operations against Taliban fighters apparently are going on in Afghanistan. Well, they're not anymore. Why is he there?
That's a question to put to the government. We don't know the answer.
I mean, have you filed a habeas or something? Get him out?
There's been a habeas proceeding pending in D.C. for the last 14 years.
There's been no action. They don't decide it?
I'm sorry?
I mean, you just let it sit there. All right. I guess this is not relevant, but I'm just curious.
Personally, I'm not handling that proceeding. But no, my understanding is that we've done everything we could to move it forward, but it simply has not moved forward.
That's an excerpt from the oral arguments in the Supreme Court case, United States versus Zubaydah. We're joined now by two guests. Ray Bonner is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He's producing a documentary with Alex Gibney about Abu Zubaydah and the CIA's interrogation program called The Forever Prisoner. His latest article for ProPublica is, Will the United States Officially Acknowledge That It Had a Secret Torture Site in Poland? Also with us, Joe Margulies, an attorney for Abu Zubaydah, professor of law and government at Cornell University. He was counsel of record in the landmark Guantanamo case, Rasul versus Bush. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Joe, let's begin with you. You're part of the legal team. The case argued before the Supreme Court. Talk about the significance of the oral arguments yesterday. And when you use words like habeas corpus, explain exactly what that means.
Of course. Thanks. Sure. It was an extraordinary argument in several respects. The narrow question is whether we can secure the testimony of James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen for use by the Polish prosecutors in their investigation into whether crimes were committed in Poland at the black site there. But the more important turn that the oral argument took is several things. One, virtually every justice on the court described Abu Zubaydah's treatment as torture. They used that word. There were no euphemisms. There was no equivocation. Everyone understood that what happened to him was torture. Second was the observation that you made, which is the questions by Justice Breyer, Justice Gorsuch, and Justice Sotomayor asking, why is it that you can't just let Abu Zubaydah testify? That obviously would obviate the need for Mitchell and Jessen's testimony. And what was as interesting as their request that Abu Zubaydah be allowed to testify was the government's equivocation and inability to answer that. They were asked, the Solicitor General was asked to provide a follow-up statement, so they'll be filing something else, explaining whether they're going to allow Abu Zubaydah to testify. And if they do, that will be a sea change at Guantanamo. That will be a radical change. Guantanamo was built to be an isolation chamber, and they have never allowed any detainee to have uncensored access to the outside. The whole purpose of it was to prevent that kind of communication. So if that changes, that will be a radical thing. And the third piece that was really interesting was Justice Breyer's observation, which we have been arguing on Abu Zubaydah's behalf for some time, as well as other detainees have made this argument, that there are no hostilities left in Afghanistan. The legal justification for continuing to hold guys has disappeared. We've been making that argument, and yesterday we heard a Supreme Court justice accept it as though it were commonplace. How could anyone think otherwise? Well, of course, that's what we've been saying for some time.
As you speak, we're showing for our web and television audience around the world the artwork of Abu Zubaydah in Guantanamo. Raymond Bonner, it's great to have you with us. Can you talk about the story of Abu Zubaydah? Tell us who he is. You're doing a documentary, The Forever Prisoner, on him.
Yes, he was the first terrorist suspect captured after 9/11. He was captured in seized in Pakistan in a joint CIA, FBI, to some extent Pakistani police operation. And he was rendered, he's the first captured, he was the first taken to a secret prison. I mean, I've interviewed both the CIA, the head of the CIA operation and the FBI operation at the time. And Zubeda was taken, the first to be rendered to a secret site. He was taken to Thailand. And soon after he got there is when James Mitchell and then Bruce Jessen showed up and began the interrogation. And as Joe just pointed out, it was very interesting yesterday in the argument to hear, and Justice Barrett included, talking straight about torture. What happened to Zubeda was torture. There was none of this euphemisms like EITs, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques. And he was the guinea pig in a way. This is where Mitchell designed the program and tested the program of torture. You know, Amy, it's always struck me that a lot is made of the 83 times he was waterboarded. If you read what was done to him, read in the government cables that were sent at the time. I mean, to me, the waterboarding was almost benign. I mean, they kept him sleepless. They put him in a small coffin-sized box for hours overnight. He couldn't move. They hung him by the cell bars and with his feet dangling off the ground. I mean, it got to the point it was so bad that Mitchell would just snap his fingers and Zubeda would get onto the waterboard. I mean, what they did to him was far worse, in my view, than waterboarding. And then when journalists started to get onto the story about a secret prison, and you got to remember this was back in 2002, and we didn't know about secret prisons and black sites. And when they found out about it and started to ask questions, then the CIA moved him to Poland. And quietly, of course, secretly, and which leads to the case, as Joe has described, that's in the Supreme Court, that was heard in the Supreme Court yesterday. But if I could say one more thing about yesterday's argument, in addition to the 3 points Joe raised, I was gobsmacked when they started asking the lawyers about Zubeda's habeas petition. 14 years ago, Justice Roberts asked about it, too. Well, hasn't he filed a habeas petition? Yes, he has. 14 years ago. And Joe Margulis was his lawyer then. 14 years, and the court has yet to rule on his habeas petition. And it's unprecedented. It's always dangerous to say because somebody will find a case that's taken longer than 14 years. But it's just staggering that for 14 years we've had two judges have now had the case in the D.C. District Court, the federal court in Washington, D.C., and they've yet to rule. You know why? The cables are there. Because in 2002, Mitchell and the CIA interrogators in Thailand sent a cable to Washington saying, we're about to do these EITs, the torture of this guy. He might die, they said. He might die. And if he does, we're going to cremate him. And if he doesn't, we want assurances that he will never be in a position to tell his story. And Langley cabled back, you have the assurances of everyone here that he will be held incommunicado for the remainder of his life. And that is exactly what is happening. We're never going to hear from Abu Zubeda. I would be stunned if he's allowed to testify.
But you were stunned yesterday. And just to finish up that part of the story that you've written so extensively about these partially declassified cables that show, they said, if he dies, they'll cremate him. But you write, if he survived questioning, Gina Haspel, who became CIA director under Trump, sought assurances that, quote, the subject will remain in isolation and incommunicado for the remainder of his life.
Exactly. I'm not sure it was Gina Haspel, Amy. We don't know who exactly signed the cable at that time, because they've been redacted to a degree that we don't know who the signatories are. We just know the language of it. And they're quite revealing.
And they certainly probably came from the Alex station, as you know, which was the group at the CIA that was trying to find Osama bin Laden. Joe may know who sent those cables.
So, Joe, if you could tell us that, and also tell us about the significance of the CIA black site in Poland. Now, let's remember, it's the Biden administration that's fighting to keep all of this secret. The Biden administration.
Yes, that's right. Our litigation began during the Trump administration, and the Trump administration sought the review in the United States Supreme Court. And there was the passing of the baton between Trump and Biden while the case was pending. And the Biden administration picked up the Trump administration's argument and doubled down on it. So there's no window, there's no air between the two administrations. What Ray describes is exactly right. But what he's describing is the torture that took place in Thailand, which was the first black site. Abu Zubaydah was the first person thrown into a black site, the first person to have his interrogation, quote, enhanced. And we know a fair amount about what happened to him at Thailand. But we don't know what happened to him in Poland. We know that in testimony, James Mitchell described it, just said that Abu Zubaydah was treated very shabbily. But he uses those kind of euphemisms for the most grotesque torture. And that's all he says. But no one has ever questioned him about what went on in Poland. The Polish prosecutor knows where the site was. He knows when it operated. But inside the cell, he doesn't know. There were only three people there. It was Abu Zubaydah, James Mitchell, and Bruce Jessen. And they won't let Abu Zubaydah testify. So if we're going to get at what happened there, we have to get it from James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who, I should say, are perfectly willing to provide this testimony. When we sought their testimony in this case, they said, we have no objection. We're happy to tell you. We're happy to sit down for a deposition. It was the United States government that intervened and said, no, their testimony is a state secret and you can't have any of it. The other thing I would want to observe, it's important to remember this. Even Mitchell and Jessen, when they were torturing him in Thailand, after 6 days of virtually 24-hour-a-day torture, they decided that they were done, that they had emptied the content of his head, and they had concluded that they had gotten all the information they needed from him, or all the information he had to give. And they cabled that to CIA headquarters in Langley. And Mitchell believes it was Jose Rodriguez who cabled back, someone in the Alex station, who, in James Mitchell's words, you guys are a bunch of pussies. You got to continue this. Blood is going to be on your hands if there's another attack. Keep torturing it. And so they did for another 2 weeks. And what they eventually concluded is that Abu Zubaydah was telling the truth all along. And contrary to what they believed when they started torturing him, he was not a member of Al-Qaeda. He had no involvement with the planning for 9/11. He's never been a member of Al-Qaeda. He is ideologically opposed to Al-Qaeda, which is what he had been saying. And they eventually concluded that that was true.
And Joe, finally on this, you have met Abu Zubaydah. Can you talk about what condition he is in today after all of this time held for so many years, the last number of years, 15 years in Guantanamo?
No, actually, I can't, because his condition and my observation of it is classified. Everything he tells me, this is why the government's, or rather the court's question is so comical. Everything he tells me and everything I learn from him is classified at the highest level. It's top secret. So if he says to me, for instance, I'm having terrible headaches and I vomit every morning, I can't relay that to you. I can't say this is what he says. I can only write it down and then submit it to the CIA for declassification. And we have submitted over 100 pages of Abu Zubaydah's statements and recounting of what happened to him. Excuse me. And that's been submitted for years, and the CIA has never cleared it. Many years ago, they authorized me to say that I am very concerned about his welfare. Very concerned or gravely concerned, some adverb like that. And I can tell you that nothing has changed between then and now. I remain very concerned. But that's all I'm allowed to say.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Joe Margulies, attorney for Abu Zubaydah, and Raymond Bonner, investigative journalist, producing a documentary with Alex Gibney about Abu Zubaydah and the CIA's interrogation program called The Forever Prisoner. We'll link to your piece in ProPublica. Will the United States officially acknowledge that it had a secret torture site in Poland? Coming up, we'll speak to the award-winning CNN reporter Naima Avarir about how Ethiopia used its flagship commercial airline, Ethiopian Airlines, to transport weapons during the war in Tigray. Stay with us. Salam, peace, by Mahmoud Ahmed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the mounting humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia amid civil war and famine. It's been nearly a year since the Ethiopian government launched an offensive against Tigray separatists, and the United Nations estimates more than 5 million people in the country's Tigray region are now in need of humanitarian assistance in order to survive. But UN officials say Ethiopia's government is blocking the movement of medicine, food, and fuel into Tigray. In response, Ethiopian officials expelled 7 senior UN officials from Ethiopia last week, giving them just 72 hours to leave the country. The UN Security Council held an emergency meeting Wednesday to discuss the crisis in Ethiopia, where UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres pushed back on the expulsion and called for Ethiopian officials to grant unhindered aid access. Ethiopia's UN ambassador, Tayatska Selassie, pushed back in an extraordinary exchange. This is Guterres.
All efforts should be squarely focused on saving lives and avoiding a massive human tragedy. This makes last Thursday's announcement by the government of Ethiopia to expel 7 senior UN officials, most of them humanitarian staff, particularly disturbing.
Expulsion was not our primary course of action. In multiple occasions, we explained our concern to UN officials. On July 8, 2021, the Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Ethiopia wrote a letter to the UN Secretariat explaining in great details the misconducts of the UN staff that require corrective measures.
If there is any written document provided by the Ethiopian government to any UN institution about any of the 8 members of the UN that were expelled, I would like to receive a copy of that document, because I have not had any knowledge of any of them.
So that's the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres having a back and forth with Ethiopia's ambassador to the United Nations. This comes as the Ethiopian Prime Minister, the Nobel laureate Abiy Ahmed, was sworn in on Monday for a second term, even as he's come under fire for his handling of the conflict. On Wednesday, CNN reported Ethiopia's government has used the country's flagship commercial airline to shuttle weapons to and from neighboring Eritrea during the civil war. This is part of the investigation by CNN's Naima Avarir.
Ethiopian Airlines is Africa's premier carrier of passenger and freight traffic. But among the regular cargo, evidence of sinister shipments. CNN can reveal, based on documentary evidence and witnesses' accounts, Ethiopian Airlines has been transporting weapons between Ethiopia and Eritrea since the beginning of the war in Ethiopia that has seen thousands killed. According to aviation experts, this would constitute a violation of aviation law. Among the evidence are these stills that were taken on board Ethiopian Airlines flight ET-3313 and verified by CNN. It's the middle of the night. This cargo plane is being loaded by hand, a slow and unorthodox method. But look closer. This isn't usual cargo. Inside these boxes are mortars. They are being loaded onto this civilian aircraft and transported from Eritrea to Ethiopia. Here is the cargo manifest, corroborating the day and time, November 8th, 2020. The date is significant. It's just 4 days into the conflict and months before Eritrea officially admits to being involved.
That's part of the new CNN investigation by Neema Bahir called Ethiopia Used Its Flagship Commercial Airline to Transport Weapons During War in Tigray. She's an award-winning senior international correspondent for CNN. For more, she's joining us from London. Neema, welcome back to Democracy Now! This is explosive, about the explosives that the Ethiopian government was transporting. Can you lay out the significance of this and also then the response of the Ethiopian government?
Well, it goes to the heart of the narrative that Ethiopia and Eritrea have been positing right from the beginning of this conflict, that the Tigray People's Liberation Front attacked Ethiopia in their northern command, which they did. But the TPLF have always said they attacked Ethiopia because there was a joint Ethiopian-Eritrean plan to attack them, to finish them, as was put at the time. Now, Ethiopia and Eritrea have always denied that. They say November 4th, they were blindsided. They needed to launch this law enforcement operation. November 14th, the TPLF rocketed Asmara, and that was when the two former enemies turned allies came together. What we found, it untangles, it dissolves all of that narrative, because we found right from the first week of November that these flights were going back and forth, gun running between the two allies. So even before the TPLF hit Asmara, they were already planning on attacking Tigray, and Eritrea needed this weaponry to be able to come down from the north into Tigray. So this narrative that somehow the Ethiopian government was caught unawares begins to crumble. Then you also have the reality of how Ethiopian Airlines has built itself up into the name that it is today, which is through its relationship, through its decades-long alliance with the U.S. and with American aviation giant Boeing. So it is taxpayer, U.S.-funded, favorable access to U.S. markets worth hundreds of millions of dollars that has built that fleet that is now being used as an apparatus of war and to bring weaponry into a region where, by the U.S. government's own findings, ethnic cleansing is happening as we speak, Amy.
And for people who aren't familiar with the conflict, who have heard of the Ethiopian-Eritrean conflict, that being resolved, how Tigray fits into all of this?
Tigray was the region from which the senior partners in the coalition that ruled Ethiopia for almost 30 years came from. The TPLF, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, they held the presidency under Meles Zenawi and his successor before the demonstrations that installed Nobel laureate Abiy Ahmed, who himself was a part of the TPLF-led government, led coalition. So you can say that what this is an existential conflict over power, over Abiy Ahmed and his allies in neighboring Eritrea, centralizing rule and taking it back from the TPLF, who were elected to govern Tigray even after Abiy Ahmed came into power. But beyond that, more importantly, and I think often when we have these conversations about how complicated this conflict is, we allow the reality to be obscured. What this is a targeting of innocent civilians who share the same ethnicity as the former rulers of Ethiopia, in Tigray. It is a minority which has disproportionately ruled Ethiopia, but it is still a minority that has almost 6 million innocent civilians in and around those who are now part of this conflict. And it's those civilians that the Ethiopian government and its allies in the regional ethnic Amhara forces are targeting and are starving.
I want to ask you about Facebook's involvement. It was raised in the Senate hearings yesterday. But first, I want to go to your stunning investigation for CNN documenting ethnic cleansing in Ethiopia, headlined "Men Are Marched Out of Prison Camps, Then Corpses Float Down the River." We're going to play the full report now, courtesy of CNN. A warning to our listeners and viewers, report includes graphic descriptions and images.
This is the Sittit River, a source of life for the people living along its banks. For weeks, the river has been bringing with it dark secrets from the Ethiopian region of Tigray. Mangled corpses are mysteriously appearing here, downstream in Sudan.
We just got a call that three bodies were found down at the riverfront, so we're running down to see what we can see.
Garry rushes down ahead of us. He's Tigrayan, but has been living here for years. He's a key point of contact for Tigrayans driven to Sudan by the conflict. Fishermen usually spot them first and call Garry. On both sides of the border, Tigrayans keep a grim tally of those believed to have been executed by Ethiopian forces that somehow end up in the river. This is an awful job, but one Tigrayans say is their duty. We reached the first body on this small island. We must warn you, the images you're about to see are very disturbing. From the binds still biting into his skin, it's clear this man suffered a tortured death. This Tigrayan has been helping to recover the dead. He holds up the body, but the image is too gruesome to show you. His eyes, though, betray the horror in front of him.
They pulled the body out, and the stench was immediate. It clearly had been decomposing along the river for a number of days, and he was tied back with a plastic wire, clearly restrained, and part of the skull was collapsed in. It's just a horrible, horrible sight.
They move to pick up someone else. Garry makes notes of the bodies and their markings. He's trying to piece together this mystery for his people. He doesn't trust anyone to do it for them. Among the flotsam, another body.
His legs were amputated.
Sudanese authorities take photographs as evidence. This is a crime scene, but the potential perpetrators are far from here, in Ethiopia. The second body is put into the same body bag. They have such few resources, but are determined to maintain a certain dignity. They're buried near the river in a shallow grave, in hope that one day they will be exhumed and reburied in their homeland. For now, though, there are only two shovels and a pick. Others join in, pushing the earth with their bare hands. Laid to rest on unconsecrated ground, the Christian Tigrayans desperately try to give respect to their dead, marking the grave with a makeshift cross held together with a single face mask. A new dawn rises. Witnesses and local authorities tell us it brings with it 11 new bodies. For months now, we have been investigating atrocities committed by Ethiopian and allied forces in Tigray. It's clear to us this marks a new chapter in the ethnic cleansing of the region. But here in Sudan, there are survivors.
Alfin.
The living speaking on behalf of the dead. Escapees, eyewitnesses from the Ethiopian border town of Humara, describe to us a renewed campaign of mass incarcerations and executions.
The numbers that they're telling us are extraordinary. We're talking about possibly over 10,000 people detained just for being Tigrayan, they say.
We begin to piece together the puzzle. We are here in Sudan, in Wadi al-Hilal. Upstream in Ethiopia is Humara.
Based on descriptions from multiple escaped detainees, Humara and its surroundings have become a mass detention facility. We were able to pinpoint the locations. Andeyata Barak, a storage facility. The electric goods warehouse Neked and Mibret Haile, where electric wire is stored. Bet Hinsat, the old prison. Endaguna, the sesame warehouse. The list goes on. Via eyewitness testimony and satellite imagery, we verified the existence of at least 7 mass detention facilities in Humara, where torture is rampant, and 2 outside town, including a military camp, Endahawaja. These are pictures of Tigrayan victims, husbands, fathers, sons. Many show victims restrained using the same small-gauge yellow electrical wire identified by eyewitnesses as having been stored in the electric goods warehouse in Humara. CNN spoke to multiple eyewitnesses and international and local forensic experts. Most of the victims were tortured, executed, piled on top of each other, most likely in a facility or a mass grave, before ending up in the river. After examining the bodies, experts were able to pinpoint one of the techniques used. Victims had their arms tied back at the elbows in an excruciatingly painful torture position. In the last few weeks, Tigrayans say the bodies of over 60 victims have floated into Sudan from Ethiopia. Evidence of a methodical campaign, one which bears all the hallmarks of genocide as defined by international law. Up in this remote corner of Sudan, this is evidence the world wasn't meant to see. Gerry takes us to see the first person he laid to rest. The water will eventually reclaim the body, but this was the best Gerry could do. Already beginning to fall apart, the body couldn't be moved. An image which still haunts him.
Leaving the body here hurts my heart. But what can I do? To leave your people by the river, your sister, your brother, not laid properly to rest, when you see that, it hurts you. It hurts your heart. But what can you do? This is what we have been condemned to.
Gerry stays vigilant, looking out towards his homeland. As long as this conflict continues, the threat of more executions, more bodies floating downstream, is ever present. Naim Al-Baghir, CNN, Wadi Al-Hilal, Eastern Sudan.
Again, the award-winning senior international correspondent for CNN, Naim Al-Baghir. That report, just astounding and important. I wanted to end by asking you about the role of social media in the— would you call it genocide in Ethiopia and Tigray, both Twitter, Facebook?
Well, genocide is a legal ruling, so we can't make that ruling, but we can and do believe it has all the hallmarks of genocide. There's no doubt that social media, especially Facebook, has played a huge role in this. It was incredibly chilling to hear that testimony in front of Congress because it mirrored so much the experience of that I have gone through, that other journalists attempting to report on this have gone through, the way that hate has been weaponized, the incitement to violence out there in the open on Facebook and other platforms has been really difficult for all of us. But thankfully, so many people are persisting in their coverage of this, including you. I really have to thank Democracy Now!, Amy, because you guys, right from the beginning, have been amplifying our work and amplifying the tragedy in Tigray. And it is so important to keep doing that.
Naim, I want to thank you for being with us. Your incredibly brave reporting, Naim Al-Baghir, award-winning senior international correspondent for CNN, speaking to us from London. The most recent CNN investigation, Ethiopia used its flagship commercial airline, Ethiopian Airlines, to transport weapons, we'll link to, as well as her previous work. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for 2 positions, a director of finance administration and a human resources manager. manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gozder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warner, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tim Ria, Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriano Contreras. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.